Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Indian Religions. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, today I get to speak with Dr. E.H. Rick Jarreau, who is Associate Professor of Religion and Asian Studies at Vassar College. We'll be speaking on a brand new translation and commentary on a very important Indic text. His publication is called The Cloud of Longing, a new translation and eco-aesthetic study of Kalidasa's Meghadhuta. This is hot off the press's brand new 2021 OUP publication. Rick, a hearty welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Raj. Thank you very much.
I was delighted to see this title, as I was sort of every once in a while, maybe two or three times a year, I'll go hunting for some titles. But often people will email me. I was delighted to see this title. So for those in the audience who will certainly have heard of the Meghadhuta, perhaps not, why don't we situate how important this is or significant? What is this Kalidasa's Meghadhuta?
Well, officially, it's a Khanda Kavya, or a shorter classical poem, which, according to later, we call them poeticians, critics, has certain qualities in it. Primarily, lyric poetry, still situated in the Indian epic universe. Most people date the Kalidasa around the 4th century. I have no idea. I often quote the Indologist Dwight D. Whitney, who says that as far as Indology is concerned, dates are like bowling pins. You set them up to knock them down again. I remember speaking with my mentor, Barbara Stoller Miller, who is translated Kalidasa's plays, and she had been in a process of translating Kumara Sambhava, and she always said that we need a new translation of the Meghadhuta. And I find it particularly timely because of the darshan, the vision of nature that this poem offers, which for me makes it topically significant as well as classically relevant. I mean, it's a stunningly beautiful poem, but beyond its lyric beauty, there's a kind of a vision of the natural world, which is quite remarkable for me.
We'll dive into that important theme for sure. So this is a very beautiful Sanskrit poem. How long is the poem and what sort of Sanskrit is it?
Well, there are so many versions, and this is always an interesting question in classical Indian literature because they have something called critical editions, in which scholars and now computers look at all the recensions of a text and try to cull the verses that are, quote, authentic, because it appears in most of them. I've never bought into the idea of a critical edition. I think it's an imposition, a mono kind of narrative imposition. But that some editions the poem is 110 verses, some it's 108 verses, some it's 111 verses. That's why I brought that up. But it's short compared to epic poems. So it's quite, I think that's one reason it's manageable, but it's also quite eloquent, flowery, and difficult Sanskrit.
So we've had a couple of podcasts, a number of podcasts actually, diving into this critical edition issue, whether the translation of the Vishnu Purana, whether the Skanda Purana project, and the various views. Obviously, there's some utility in them, clearly, and there's no shortage of issues and pitfalls. So what did you end up using then as the text from which you translated?
So I look through, you know, S.K. Day has the critical edition of the Meghaduta. But I decided to kind of stay in the lineage that the poem has already been translated in, you know, in the West. And that was through Leonard Nathan's, you know, work in the 1980s. I'm not sure. I think he was using the manuscript that probably Ed Giroux gave him, but I suspect there's one recension, Dakshinavartana recension, that I think he used. It's 100 and how many verses? 10 or 11. But I decided to stay with the version that Nathan used to make things less complicated. If I wanted to standardize anything, I'd put 108 verses, but I'm not going to be the one to decide which is, you know, who's the real Kalidasa.
These are fascinating questions.
Which brings up, just on the side note, a really interesting issue about the Ritu Samhara, was, you know, Kalidasa's other poem, because this, I think, exemplifies the critical edition argument. If you go to India, you go to Kalidasa Academy, you talk to, you know, scholars in India, everyone considers Ritu Samhara to be part of the Kalidasa oeuvre, where Western professors do not. They think it was done by some inferior hand.
Yeah, there's an ongoing and fascinating tension with respect to looking at a text or textual tradition from an etic or an emic perspective, and the right sorts of questions we bring to bear on the work. And there's much to be said. So it's always really fascinating. That's why I ask these questions. I probably should have primed you before I hit record, but I tend to ask naive questions on this podcast to see what comes. And the next one that comes to mind is, how do you go about translating the verses? Like, what's that process like?
I know,
right?
that's a loaded and interesting question, because the way I work, and I suspect a lot of people work, is the first step is to get the literal translation, and that's a lot of dictionaries and a lot of commentaries to see how different words are used. The next step is to look at all the translations that we have, and there are quite a few, and there's some that are incredibly liberal, let's put it that way, flights of fancy, and there are others that are literally accurate but unreadable in an English vernacular. So you have to, once you have we call the Abhidhar, or the basic denotative, you know, translation, then you have so many choices. First of all, because Sanskrit syntax does not demand any particular word order. So as a translator, you have the freedom to kind of move things around. Secondly, because as you know, just about every word in the Sanskrit language has multiple meanings. There are many ways to do it. I kind of worked a lot to get the literal, looked at a lot of translations. Leonard Nathan was interesting because I still consider it a breathtakingly beautiful translation. a lot of, quote, purist scholars do not like it because it took so many liberties with the text. But that becomes the kind of the fulcrum of controversy. Like, where do you take liberties and how do you not? And my model, I think I was fortunate because I had a model to work from, which was Barbara Stoller Miller, who, you know, and I follow kind of what her methodology, which is you take poetic liberties, but you have to defend every single one of them. So that's what I basically do in the footnotes. I kind of tell people like why I translated this way. But it's poetry. It's multiple meanings. It's different contexts. And that's an interesting issue that you kind of brought up. There's the text and the context. Kavya was court poetry as far as we know. And we don't know that much. We always like to imagine we know more than we do. But most likely it was poetry that was recited by upper classes in the court. And it was not a private reading experience that we have in the West. And I do my best to keep that in mind. But what I've tried to do here is not only translate, but discuss the text in a way that it's not only available to Sanskrit specialists, but to people anywhere who are interested in literature, and particularly poetry, because from, you know, if you read poems like the Meghaduta through the Rasadvani critical tradition, I just find it's endlessly rich, and you can go many different directions with it.
There's this really interesting tension when it comes to translation or even studying narrative. The translation is both a science and an art, it seems to me. You know, there are obviously principles in terms of understanding and rendering the meaning, the sense, the tenses, the syntax. And then there is how do I convey the flavor, the cadence, the alliteration, right, in a different language? And some months back, I had Archana Venkatesan on the podcast. She did a translation of a very rich poem called Tiruvaimoli, Endless Song. And she was talking about her process in terms of letting the original verse sit with you, sort of digesting it. And it may not come out. It comes out in a way that feels true to what you experience in the original language, right, irrespective of how parallel the actual syntax and word choices.
Very good. I like that. That's kind of what I experience. I like that very much. Because, you know, you're dealing with, as you said, cadence, you know, orality and rhyme. And I've seen versions where people try to translate the, you know, or like Whitney's the earliest. No, was it Whitney? No, who did that earliest? 1837. What's that?
Whitney did a book on roots, Sanskrit roots.
Yeah, no. One of the H.H. Wilson, one of the earliest translations where he does a poetic, he does it in English poetry and, you know, rhyme and it sounds, to me anyway, contrived, and it's very difficult to read. So I have found it necessary to translate in free verse and to kind of let the meter suggest itself instead of imposing a Munda Krantha meter on another language, which is not workable for me.
Yeah, there's some really interesting parallels. There was also a podcast with Macamas Taylor of Australian National University. He's done a brand new open access translation of the Vishnu Purana in blank verse, right?
Mm-hmm, right?
It's in blank verse, and it's really beautiful to read aloud. Right. The reason why that came to mind is that H.H. Wilson was, he translated the Vishnu Purana and basically said, look, there's nothing much to see here, folks. so it was a while before the Puranas were again translated. or taken seriously as objects of study. There's so much interesting here that the orality piece is crucial. A question for you. Do you envision this book to be read aloud, both? What's your sense?
I would love the poem to be read aloud, and I kind of translate it aloud. And I actually, at the last stage, I read it aloud with friends of mine who are poets, just to see how it's going to, you know, how it works. Because we're getting back to that with electronic media and the convergence of sound and sense in electronic media. But I think history will show that the experience of private personal reading is going to be a rather short one, you know, maybe, you know, a few hundred years, but 1,000 years at most. So, and that's what I like it. The classical Indian vision of time is quite different than the one people who are reading this are going to be accustomed to. But I see it. I would like it to be read aloud and listened to aloud. Is that possible? I don't know, but that's how I work with it. And I find when I, you know, read it aloud in the translated version, the English version, it's that's when I can really feel if it's working or not. You know, reading it silently and looking for whatever you're looking for is not the same experience. It, for me, it does not transmit rasa, and that's the goal. The goal of the literary work of art in India is to produce rasa. And in order to produce rasa, you have to recognize it. And Abhinavagupta says you recognize it by reading again and again and again, like a wish-fulfilling cow. You keep getting new possibilities.
So many thoughts. Which one to start with? Okay, in no particular order. The idea of rasa, for those listening, most of you might be familiar with this concept of literally taste, flavor. But in aesthetic theory, it's the flavor of the work, the taste of it. And it's interesting that the taste occurs on the tongue. And recitation occurs on the tongue.
Exactly.
And there are many a times where I'll tell a Puranic story for my teaching, or in my scholarship, occasionally a snippet in an academic talk or something. But for teaching, I always, you know, regale them with tales of old and unpack them, because then they'll never forget the themes, right? And every once in a while, I'll get a question, when I was doing the reading, you know, that didn't happen to Ganesha, you know, and I say to them, you have to understand the text is on the tongue. You get to witness live, real storytelling in real time. This is being told to you as a function of this time, this space, this audience, right? So there is that tension between the textual authority and then the living tradition. Yeah. And I think that's very much, I think in my view, that's only, heightened in the realm of poetry.
You know, the person who, one of the people I read Meghadutta with and studied, Dr. Casey Bhattacharya, who taught at BHU, he was legally blind. He couldn't read anything. He had the entire poem memorized along with many other things, and he just recite, you know, and that's the way it's meant to, that's how you feel it. And I think the real interesting contrast between the written word and the text and the spoken word is the amazing thing that if you go to Western academic institutions and you read poetry, that the question they kind of work with is, what does it mean? And that would never occur to a rasika. It's, what does it taste like? And the other thing I think that's so wonderful about the tradition of kavya is the onus is on the reader or the hearer, not the artist. They talk about the pratibha. They'll briefly talk about the genius of Kalidasa, but not very long. The ability to experience rasa is in the court of the ball's in the court of the reader or the hearer.
It's lovely. So tell us a little bit about what you say about Kalidasa.
Well, I can't tell you anything about Kalidasa because nobody knows anything. There's stories, you know, there are these great stories about how he was an illiterate kind of guy who was visited by the goddess Kali and all of a sudden started spouting these poetry. Most scholarship puts him in the Gupta court, you know, the early Gupta court. But this is what's, I think, so interesting and connects to modern literary criticism. I studied for years with Michael Riefenstahl, the French literary semiotic theory, and he used to always insist the author is just the label on the text. So we don't know much about Kalidasa, and I think that's kind of the way it should be. On the other hand, what he's writing about, everybody knows, like, because it's all based on epic narrative, and the epic narrative is part of the cultural respiration, you know, it's there. And if you don't know it, even the landscape doesn't make sense. And that's one of the things I love about the poem, that it integrates language, love, and various variants of textual history. In fact, this idea of variance versus a so-called critical narrative, you can almost see like that is kind of a function of the idea of a critical, you know, edition is kind of the function of the contemporary industry of translation. It's convenient, it's helpful, we're all on the same page, but that's not how people talk or write. Almost any story you run into, there'll be multiple variants. And scholars of myth can point that out. What makes a myth myth is that there are multiple variants.
What do you say in your question?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's always, the questions are always meant to be generative. What do you say in your section about the tantric Kalidasa?
Okay. You know, I took this, I knew I was expecting to get gunned down by a lot of people for using this word, but I actually got it.
I come in peace. I'm holding the Abhaya Mudra, you know, you fear not, we're good.
But I actually, way back when I first read Meghaduta with Barbara Miller, she mentioned that there was something tantric about the text. And I kind of moved with that. And I said, you know, what is it? And it's very clear. It's kind of a corrective for me to the, what should we call it, ascetic philosophical tradition that separates Purusha, Prakriti, nature and spirit. It incorporates all the senses along with language. So I like to say the sensibility is tantric, in that the sensibility is immanent versus transcendent, but not immanent in a way that, you know, some people put kavya in the realm of kama, you know, completely. And I have to disagree with that. But it offers a vision of things, of reality, in which there are no strict dichotomies, nature, spirit, language, and substance. So in that sense, I see its sensibility as tantric.
You know, I'm a scholar of narrative. I typically study, my main work was on the Devi Mahatmya, the epics. And so, you know, I don't study Tantra. I'm not involved in Tantra studies. But for me, as of late, it's dawned on me that there are so many tantric themes in the Devi Mahatmya, yet there's no overt mention of Tantra. And yet there's so many nods and so many themes. If I were to make an argument, I would say clearly the author or authors were influenced by tantric Hinduism, if not tantricas themselves. Who knows? It's sort of a Trojan horse tantric text. But, yeah, you know, well, And
a
poet by the name of Kalidasa. I mean, Kali is
exactly, and that to me is another characteristic of Tantra, which you find in a lot of in enough Kavya, which is the redeeming aspect of the feminine. Whether that's the Devi or whether that's the natural world, that is, you know, that is where redemption lies.
It's fascinating. Is there a section, a verse that we can perhaps give a taste of aloud that we can read
in English, or
the audience would be primarily English speaking.
Let me read,
but feel free to also read the Sanskrit. Well, because just to give a sense of the beauty.
Let me see if I can get the Sanskrit up. I had it up before.
Sure, either or whatever is readily available to you.
But it's interesting. I'll read the first few verses because they set up the rest of the text, and they also give you at least the rationale and the issue about this question in the fifth verse about how can a cloud blend of, I'll read my translation. It says, what does a cloud blame of smoke, a blend of smoke, flame, water, and wind have to do with meaningful message meant to be conveyed by the fit senses of the living? Heedless of this, from ardent fervor, the Yaksha made his request. For lovers afflicted by passion can no longer tell the aware from the inert. Chaitanas Chaitaneshu. The cloud is supposedly inanimate. So how does the inanimate world carry animation? And it's really interesting in this regard, because right now, as far as I can see on the planet, there are kind of two competing visions of nature and consciousness. You know, there's the Christian Hindu, which puts consciousness somewhat apart from nature. And then there's the Buddhist cognitive science version, which sees consciousness as emergent out of nature. And Kalidasa in this verse, he skirts this issue. He says, well, what's that verse in the Gita? Dumi apo nalo vayu kamano buddhi evacha. These are the elements of Prakriti. Earth, air, fire, water, mind, buddhi, ahankara, however you translate these, ego. And yet the way that meaning is carried here is not through a cognitive process, but it's kam artahi, those who are afflicted by kama. And in that sense, we have an extremely tantric vision, because in mainstream Hindu thinking, kama is often seen as an affliction, something that you rise above, either through dharmic prescription or intense ascetic discipline or whatever. Whereas here, it being afflicted by kama, either you can read this, it makes somebody insane. You cannot tell consciousness. You know, it's chaitanas chaitaneshu. Chaitana is a word for consciousness. So they can't tell the living from the dead, because either they've gone mad or they've gone beyond. And it just reminds me of a wonderful experience I've had many times, where I spent many years living in Vrindavan and hanging out in the marketplace. And there's this one man who hangs out in the marketplace. His pants are entirely ripped. His butt is sticking out. He doesn't talk. He has this kind of weird smile, and he bums tea at different tea stalls. And I asked my friend, some people would say informant, who is this person? And the answer was, he is somebody who does not know what is Maya. So he's seen as some kind of gone beyond avadut mast, you know, something like this. So there's an exaltation of the fever, which in other texts, Buddhist texts, is saying the whole world is burning. But here the burning is kamartahi. It takes you into a different reality. So that's a nice verse. One verse that I love, if I can find it, is when, you know, what's happening in the text, for those who have not read it or don't know it, is this exiled yaksha, who is a comparatively insignificant semi-divine being in the whole, you know, hierarchy of being. He's exiled on a mountain due to some infraction, which is never specified, but it seems to have something to do with karma. And he's pining for his lost beloved, who's back at his home. And he spots a cloud in the sky, and he asks the cloud to deliver a message. And the cloud never speaks back, but he, the yaksha describes to the cloud the route that he is to take, which is through various provinces of the land that we now call India, which is amazingly detailed and accurate in its description of things, and at the same time, philosophically acute. For example, the second verse, on that hill, lovelorn and months from his mate, his wrist so wasted that it had shed its golden bracelet, he saw during the full month of Ashada a cloud nuzzling a mountain ridge, like a handsome elephant playfully butting the side of the hill. So there are themes here that you find throughout the Sanskritic tradition. One is viraha, which is love and separation. This is what makes the bangle fall from the wrist so wasted, because I'm pining after my beloved. And there's this incredible tradition that the deepest experience of love is not the union with your mate, but it's when your beloved has disappeared and you're left in this incredible agony, which is so deep that it actually gets cultivated. And for those who don't know, like, the interesting theological history is that the Vaishnav theologians took the Megadutta and works like it, and recast the Sanskrit aesthetics in terms of bhakti theology. So they took, you know, if rasa is the goal, the feeling that the work of art produces. And it's interestingly, Bharata, who Natya Shastra, does not locate rasa in the text. He locates it in the interaction between the audience, the actors, and the play. So it's an interactive relational process. And so here, the lovelorn yaksha, whose golden banglet is falling, and this particular trope is taken pretty much word for word from Kalidas's other Shakuntala, where we have another golden bangle falling. And then during the full moon of Ashada, the full moon month of autumn here, is fraught with reminiscences of love and separation and lovers who can't get back and union and a cloud nuzzling a mountain ridge. A lot of Western scholars wondered, why would the great poet Kalidasa write a poem on something such as trifling as a cloud? In fact, in the very, unlike other kavyas, the first verse of the Megadutta, there's no hero mentioned. There's no benediction mentioned. This is not a traditional beginning of a kavya. Kaschit kanta viraha guna swadik vrat pramataha. Some old yaksha, you know, it could have been anybody. So he immediately tells you that this is not, the rasa here is not virabhav. It's not about the heroic. It's about something else. And so, just to finish this thought, the cloud playfully butting the side of a mountain. Some of the words used for playful, like parinata, is also a word in Sanskrit aesthetics, how literal meaning gets transformed into metaphorical meaning, or what we call dvani, or suggestion. So there's an amazing, I don't know how this, you know, this is the genius of this poet, the amazing integration of Sanskrit critical awareness with the properties of nature. And this includes gods and humans. At one point, the cloud goes to Mount Kailash, which is the abode of Shiva. And there's a tree with its branches raised up in the air. And that tree, those branches are seen as the arms of the god Shiva. And the twilight, the rakta, the red twilight energy of the sun coming through the arms of the tree is seen as the blood that fell from this gaja, this elephant that Shiva killed and turned into a drum. And the thunder of the cloud becomes the drum. Now, here's where tantric comes in, because someone might say, oh, how imaginative. The poet has ascribed mythical scenes to nature. But the tantric way of reading it is, no, this is actually happening, that nature is a pageant, and gods, humans, history, people are all incorporated in this vision, and this celebration is going on. And what motivates it is the anguish of love and separation, which is the engine that distills the rasa.
That's the perfect segue to my next question, which is the translation subtitle is a new translation and eco-aesthetic study of Meghaduta. How is this an eco-aesthetic study?
You know, this is what got me interested. Barbara Miller always said we need another translation of the Meghaduta, but do we need another translation of anything? There's so much available. But when I began retroactive reading for the upteenth time, it just occurred to me that what is being offered here is more than a beautiful fancy. It's a way of experiencing and looking at the natural world, which is genuinely topical. It's genuinely significant. Is the world inert, or is it intelligent, or is it, in the vision of Kalidasa, there is no natural world apart from the stories about it. And this is also true in Aboriginal songline traditions. And I've read books about placemaking among the Apache people, that there's the sense of place. The word I use, and this gets back to the tantric, for the sense of nature and place is loka. Because the word loka incorporates like many different meanings. It literally means a place. It can also mean a realm in terms of the type of place it is. It can also mean a people. And it's from the verbal root luka, lokika, which is the sight or the vision. So you have a vision, a place, and a people. And they're not distinguishable. They're part of the fabric of nature. And, I've worked at Vassar College could be correctly described as a left-leaning Northeast liberal university, college, where people and scholars who like to think themselves as progressive have established programs in environmental studies. But if you really look at the content of these programs, and they are 99% based on, quote, scientific visions of what is nature, quantifying gases, elements, whereas the idea that you cannot really connect to nature without the aesthetic appreciation doesn't enter into a lot of contemporary environmental discourse. And in fact, the only, I'm sure there are others, but the only two Western scholars who I know who really talk about this are not Sanskritists and not literary people. They're, I guess you would call the late James Hillman a depth psychologist. And I think Hillman's mentor, Henri Corbin, who studied Islam and Islamic aesthetics, and talk about hima, or the appreciation through the heart as a kind of third pathway. I think that the vision of nature in the Meghaduta exemplifies this, and it's telling me that without imagination, your nature is just an objective fantasy. It's what Blake called Newton's compass.
There's, as you're speaking, what comes to mind, the podcast is really a space to spotlight whatever work we're currently talking about. I don't, you know, take sides particularly in terms of methodology or conclusions or this or that. But I have to say, much of what you say resonates. What's coming to mind is, I believe it was last month or a couple of months ago, in the timeless time of this COVID world we're in. I was asked to do the occasional public talk, and it was for a group called, what was it called? Hindu Climate Action. I believe that there's some connection. They're affiliated in some way with the OCHS where I teach, but okay. they weren't looking particularly for an environmentally oriented talk. They are always interested in sort of enriching their knowledge of Hinduism, right? And so I thought, okay, well, it happened to be around Navaratri. I thought, okay, it's Navaratri. This is my area. Let's present on the Devi and the Devi Mahatmya and the vision in that text. And as I was preparing the slides, I realized, okay, this is a fantastic text to present with respect to their interests. And the talk was called Why the Goddess Cares About Activism or Climate Issues. It's a worldview that's radically different from the one we've internalized. We've internalized our collective civilization that we're teaching and speaking in, has internalized a notion of nature being a created thing separate from humanity and divinity. And it's a radically different view in the Devi Mahatmya, even within the Hindu world, where it's saying the Devi is the supreme divine, is the fabric of nature. And she's hymned as to that goddess who lives in all beings in the form of hunger, sleep, thirst, etc., in the very natural world. Right. And that's a completely different vision. That's one where that's a sort of theological or philosophical platform that is conducive to why one would see, you know, the grandeur of the divine in nature, quite literally.
Yeah. That resonated something. I was, you see, I immediately, I just noticed in myself the predilection to kind of retreat into philosophy. So in my silence, I was thinking about this relationship between self and nature. And the when the Vaishnava theologians like took the Meghaduta and people like Jiva Goswami, they said, Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva, which is like the Vaishnava version of Rupa Shunyataiva Shunyataiva Rupam, that things are simultaneously one and different. So in many ways, Meghaduta offers an interesting resolution to the self-other, self-nature dichotomy in that, yes, we are, you know, we're part of nature and we're separate at the same time. And yet that I think the other insight into the natural world is that there's no objective world. This is where the tantra comes in, without the story that you have around it. I have a friend, I call him the disgruntled poet, Sharad Chandra, who hangs out in a coffee house somewhere in North India. And he once suggested when I was working on this, he said, you know what you should do? I said, no, tell me. He always tells me what I should do. He said, you should go to these different sites that Kalidasa describes in Meghaduta and film them as they are today. And it would be devastated because Dr. Bhattacharya used to tell me, you know, I've never seen the stucco roofs of Ujjayini, you know, that Kalidasa talks about. In fact, when I was studying Meghaduta with Dr. Bhattacharya, he lived like 100 yards from Ganga in Benares. So every day to walk to his, you know, dwelling, I walked by Ganga's. I was living by Ganga's side anyway. And finally, one day, I just couldn't take. I said, tell me, you know, you have all the knowledge. Why is the Ganga so dirty? You know, this is the holiest river in the world. Why is, you know, and it was really interesting. He immediately blamed it on Shankara. Because if you reduce everything to Maya, what does it matter if the river is dirty or not? I think there are reasons why texts like the Meghaduta, I would argue, have been marginalized. Whereas, you know, you have epics of, you know, epic TV shows of Ramayana and Mahabharata, but Meghaduta does not offer a well-known story. And it offers an experience of the natural world that we might have on a beautiful day, but we generally don't live with that, that we're part of this living continuum. And I think Meghaduta, what's so beautiful for me and powerful, and why I love this text so much, it doesn't illustrate it, it embodies it. It just, and this would put people like, I don't know, Saussure, Fernandez Saussure, you know, in mental institutions, like, and Descartes, you know, people who see language as arbitrary and something different from nature. But that's not where Kalidasa is going.
So you touched on this in passing earlier, but let's flesh this out. Who is this book for? Who would most resonate with it? Who would benefit from it?
I wrote it, I constructed it for people who have an interest in world literature. It's not a book for Sanskrit specialists. You know, there's plenty of very sophisticated work on the grammar, the flora, the fauna, the history, whatever. I wanted to introduce the sensibility of Kalidasa to people who are conversant with, I don't know, Scheherazade, 1001 Nights, you know, with different visions of literature. I refer to people like William Blake extensively here, in terms of, again, the power of imagination. So and I state very early on that as a Western body and mind, I cannot help but read Kalidasa through Shakespeare, Milton, Yeats, you know, the English poetic tradition. So I wrote this for people who would read those poets, for people who would read Joseph Campbell, for people who would be interested in issues of aesthetics and imagination, but within the context of world literature. My contention is, if you've read Shakespeare, you should have read Kalidasa. And they're they're both monumental poets. And in a world in which boundaries are being weakened, if not dissolved, we need a kind of an understood body of world literature, and not just what I like to call camera tours of the other. You know, this is the Indian view. You know, the Meghaduta is challenging me. Is nature alive or dead?
Certainly the poem will offer a great deal of insight into ancient India or Kalidasa, various subfields within Indology or Hindu studies. I think I agree with you. More importantly, profound feats of culture, of the imagination, of the intellect, like profound poetry such as this, works of art, they are appealing to humanity, and they're engaging you as a person, not as a class, not as a group, not as a gender. They're engaging you about what it means to be living, breathing in flesh and sentient.
Well, let's take this a step further, which I see as the most controversial contention of this book, which is that I argue that Western literature, literary studies, has unconsciously, unknowingly, and uncritically become wed to a linear historical model of understanding. You understand an Upanishad because, you know, when was it written? You know, where? And these is, you know, and even contemporary literary critics, like, you know, in the West, like Northrop Frye, you know, talk about, you know, reader response, like it, that the text does not have to be read extrinsically. It can be read intrinsically to itself. People who study, for example, I'm not talking about boutique yoga, but real yoga, they don't really spend much time in, like, when it was founded, by whom, where. It's like, what is your practice? How does it work now? And the whole tantric idea is something that seemingly happened 10,000 years ago is just as live now, because the time is, you know, what's that great Upanishad? I forgot to say, Virachabandhanam, a verbal handle that we have put on things. But the mountains, I had a friend who went to a kind of seminar where they asked him to go out and talk to a tree. So he went out in front of a tree and he said to the tree, I have 20 minutes. What can you tell me? And the tree reputedly said back to him, I have no idea what you're talking about, what 20 minutes means. This to me is really important, that the nature Kalidasa is speaking about is not a nature that is bounded by a particular geographical or cultural construct as we would like it to be, because that makes what we're doing the latest, the greatest, the most progressive. But in fact, well, a story will tell it all. My the other late Sanskrit teacher of mine, the irascible trickster Alex Wayman, was once asked at a conference. Someone challenged him at a conference. He was a scholar of Tibetan Buddhism. Someone challenged him and said, where are you getting your information? Where are you getting this from? And he says, I'm getting this all from Tsongkhapa. And the interlocutor said, yes, but he lived in, you know, hundreds of years ago. He's been dead since the 1400s. And Wayman responded, maybe for you he is. You can see very clearly in Meghaduta that the epic, the Mahabharata, is the living, breathing backbone of this. And it's a jazz riff on Mahabharata. That's how I would really see it. The creme de la creme of Mahabharata distilled into rasa by the great poet who could see the Shama vine, you know, the beloved in the Shama vine, in the water, in the eye of a startled doe. It's important to me. It's serious because the time and space fixation has already been demolished by electronic media. And so enough said. One other part of this is the centrality of the word smara. When we say memory, which means memory as a root. And even, you know, the best historians will admit that history is nothing but the search for a plausible narrative. It's not about what happened. And T.S. Eliot, who studied Sanskrit for 3 years at Harvard, understood very well when he rewrites Chaucer at the beginning of the Wasteland, like April is the cruelest month, lilacs in the dead land, mixing memory and desire. Well, the smara, memory, is also an epithet of kama, the personification of desire. So the understanding there is any historical memory is coming from your own desire body, how you wanted to see it, how your unconscious wants to see it. So time and space become fluid.
Fascinating and provocative idea indeed. Before we close today, was there anything else you wanted to share about the book?
Yes, I guess, again, one question I always like to ask an author, and they generally don't like to answer it, so I'm going to do my best to answer it, is I say, why did you write that? Why, what motivated you to do this? And my sense is that what the Meghaduta offers is a poetic perception of reality, which has become marginalized, extremely marginalized in a like the post-Cartesian capital world fueled by capital. And it's the argument for me, or the value, is that seeing this, it's helped me see nature. I can never see a cloud in the same way again. And it brings me back to a poetic perception of reality, which is not bounded by fear of what's right and wrong, what's the meaning, what's not the meaning, but the trust is in the, it's interesting, the word in Sanskrit, and this will be a good ending for me, for someone who appreciates poetry and who can taste rasa is sahridaya, literally with heart. The heart as the organ of perception, and that's what really moves me here.
Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast. Once again, we've been speaking with Rick Giroux, professor of religion and Asian studies at Vassar College, on The Cloud of Longing, his brand new translation of Kalidasa's Meghaduta. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, and keep contemplating aesthetic experiences facilitated through the natural world. Take care.